the land. Alaska's physical grandeur and endless panorama seem to defy adequate description. In its appearance, in its massive solidness, it seems timeless and unchanging. And yet nature itself is the very essence of change, defying the apparent continuity of shape and form. Nothing, nature reminds us, remains the same. In Alaska, man's relationship with the land joins another factor in the process of natural change, the human need apart and often in conflict with nature, to make use of the land, to mold and shape it into something which remains our ultimate source of wealth, security, and freedom. In such a value system, land cannot long remain neutral. How humankind, land, and the process of change interact in Alaska varies tremendously in a relationship which itself constantly changes. The quality and the priorities of life, as they exist in scattered native villages, where luxuries are few and subsistence is both a tradition and a necessity, is a world apart from the quality and priorities of life as they exist in Anchorage. Here, 250,000 people crowd the shores of Cook Inlet, wrapped in steel and glass, where only 60 years before this urban phenomena rose from the tundra, a scraggly log and tent construction camp of 3,000 littered the bluff. The specter of change facing individual Alaskan communities is every bit as great as that confronted by Alaska's larger urban centers, whether a remote Athabascan community such as Arctic Village or a sprawling interior city like Fairbanks. To varying degrees, the portent of change is perceived as both a promise and as a threat in communities where the perception of alternatives and consequences is often blurred by heated and bitter disputes. Decision-making, therefore, quickly assumes adversary overtones. Many say that the argument rages between those who would protect the land in its pristine natural state and retard the process of change, and those who would use the land and the sea and their resources to build, to grow, and to fuel the process of change. However, between these two oversimplified and generalized extremes lie the many complex shades of compromise and common interest, which for each Alaskan community forms a unique mosaic in its own image. This is Alaska's great dilemma, and perhaps nowhere is this dilemma more clearly revealed than in four small communities, Nanana, Homer, Cordova, and Wrangell, communities where the necessity for change is being measured against the need to preserve the continuity of shared values and identities evolved through the continuum of Alaska's past. The question that faces us is whether Alaskans can have both change and continuity, on whose terms, and at what cost. The question which faces these four communities, and many like them, is how do we plan for an unpredictable future, or can we plan at all? The interior Tananaw Valley community of Nanana lazily hugs the south bank of the Tananaw River, some 55 miles southwest of Fairbanks. Located on the Yukon's largest tributary, Nanana is first and foremost a river town, and for many of the community's 500 residents, the river provides necessities of life and the benefits of community. For Nanana, the relationship has always been a vital one, as long as people have lived there. Before white men settled on the Tananaw, Athabascan Indians used this place as a seasonal home. The word Nanana means easy place to camp, and a village existed here perhaps for centuries before a white trader named Jim Duke first opened a trading post and roadhouse in 1902. Gold brought thousands to the Tananaw Valley, but in their haste to reach Cheetah and Fairbanks, gold stampeders rushed by Nanana on their way up the Tananaw. However, with the growth and development of the interior, the strategic location of Nanana quickly made it an important regional supply and transportation center. Until 1915, Nanana changed very little. It remained essentially an Indian community with only a few resident whites. In 1903, an Episcopal mission was located here, and St. Mark's and the Tananaw provided both spiritual guidance and humanitarian services for a people adjusting to white culture. Tragically, many succumbed to disease such as influenza, which decimated Indian residents. The decision in 1914 to build a railroad from the port of Seward through Broad Pass to Fairbanks completely altered Nanana. transforming a serene riverfront village into a roaring boomtown. The Nana suddenly found itself at the center of an interior transportation revolution. The quiet scraping of dog sled runners following old trails was joined by the clang of sledgehammers, the shouts of construction crews, and the laying of rails. The Nana was on the map. By 1917, with the nation gearing up for war, the Nana had grown large enough to see her own men off for the front with a patriotic dockside farewell. The railroad brought growth, and growth brought new buildings, a main street, a telephone system, and modern conveniences such as water and laundry service. In its setting, the town was well planned and well laid out, and the Nana incorporated as a first-class city in 1921. In 1923, President Warren G. Harding drove a golden spike at the Nana to officially open the Alaska Railroad, linking Fairbanks with Anchorage. No longer a railhead, the Nana instead became a stopover on the way to her much larger neighbor to the north and distant Anchorage to the south. But the foundations for her economy had been laid. With the end of railroad construction, the familiar cycle of boom and bust cooled off the Nana's economy, and construction crews departed. However, the Nana survived as long as the Tanana River remained an important interior highway. The big stern wheelers pushed barges of supplies and freight that hauled passengers up and down the river, and the Nana's docks were a swarm of activity during navigation season. In addition to livelihood, the river provided entertainment and excitement in the spring when hundreds would line the banks to watch the ice go out, opening the barge and riverboat season. Entertainment, however, could and did turn to disaster, with periodic flooding as the Tanana overflowed its banks and turned the Nana streets into canals. The railroad and the river guaranteed Nana's survival as a community, which changed with the seasons. A busy interior port and commercial center for part of the year, a town which slowed at the pace of deep winter when it was 60 below. Today, the Nana remains true to its origins. There are, of course, those things which change with time, new buildings, more people, but the river, the docks, and the railroad continue to provide jobs and economic security. Another boom period occurred during the 1960s with construction of Clear Air Force Base, 23 miles south of the Nana, and completion of one of Alaska's major transportation arteries, the Parks Highway. In 1968, the highway bridge over the Tanana was completed and opened to traffic, and the Nana is now accessible by air, river, railroad, and highway. The highway had an immediate impact on the Nana as the Tanana and Tri-Valley area was open to thousands of motorists and the trucking industry. Another dimension was added to the Nana as it became a service community. Unlike many small communities, the Nana is a diverse, individualistic, and relatively young town. It takes pride in a self-reliance based upon the labor of its seasonal workforce. During the long summer days, the sounds of heavy machinery and freight loading at the Utana Barge Company docks and the squeal of train brakes reforge the Nana's link with the past. But these links also bind the town to the realities of an Alaskan in transition and may restrict community options for growth and development should the need for the Nana's services decline. On the other hand, the Nana may be at the crossroads of dramatic change and may well find itself at the heart of a vast agricultural region. To the northwest of the Nana lie nearly 500,000 acres of potentially rich farmland, which could, if developed, tremendously increase the Nana's importance as a transportation and service center. As a consequence of expanded oil and gas exploration and production from the North Slope or increased coal production from the Healy-Suntrana area, rail connections may one day link the Arctic coast with the interior in Canada, fulfilling a dream which goes back to territorial days. Such development would have far-reaching but uncertain impacts on a community of 500. Most Nana residents look forward to such changes to provide a more stable economic base. They see Nana as a community in search of security, and they encourage directed, balanced growth. The outlook is essentially opportunistic, with community leaders urging maximum land use and development to provide the stimulus for settlement and growth. The Nana looks to its timber, its agricultural potential, and its central location astride interior transportation arteries to ensure its future viability as a community. There appears to be a consensus among the Nana's residents, over 40% of whom are of Indian ancestry, that population growth and land-based or industrial development are the keys to their children's future. Native land claims, the antiquities withdrawals, D2, and other federal and state land policy decisions are certain to greatly influence the Nana's success or failure in realizing what many view as its potential. Lacking the political or economic power to influence such major legislation, the Nana's residents are, like other small communities, somewhat at the mercy of decisions made by others, however disturbing these realities may be. Nanana, Alaska, is a small rural community born with the 20th century and nourished on optimism. It looks towards the future with faith in progress, recognizing and welcoming the inevitability of change. Yet, vestiges of traditional subsistence lifeways exist side by side with all that Western culture has brought to Alaska. These two warily confront one another as adversaries, but they also complement one another as different expressions of shared needs. This relationship, as it characterizes Nanana, conveys the image of adaptability and projects a vision for the future. Homer, a small but growing community of 2,800, lies at the lower end of the Kenai Peninsula, some 120 air miles from Anchorage, its huge neighbor to the north. Located on the north shore of Kachemak Bay, Homer is accessible by sea and by road. The best way to appreciate the beauty of Homer's setting, however, is to fly in over the Kenai Moose Range and the rivers which empty into Cook Inlet. Approaching the wide expanse of Kachemak Bay, steep lush green bluffs fall away to reveal a majestic panorama set against the backdrop of the snow-covered Kenai Mountains. Homer Spit curves out into the bay, a long sandy arch in a sea of blue, and floatplanes set down on Beluga Lake near one of Alaska's most magnificent ice-free deep-water ports. Scenic and aesthetic values have always been a major reason why people have settled in Homer. But underlying these values were others which first brought explorers and immigrants north to Homer's beaches and high bluffs, more tangible riches like gold and coal. The pioneers who came to Kachemak Bay, first Russian, then British, then Americans, many of whom were of Finnish descent, found the land sparsely settled by Tenaina Indians, hunters and fishermen who thought of themselves as the people. During the early 1800s, Russians explored the rich fur bearers and the coal seams of Bluff Point, but made no permanent settlement here. By 1899, the Cook Inlet Coal Field Company was mining Homer's rich coal seams and had laid 42-inch track from the Bluff Point mines to the end of the spit. A little settlement grew here, which soon boasted of having Alaska's first coal lamp streetlight system. The rush for gold at the turn of the century turned Kachemak Bay into a scene of brief but furious activity. Thus it was that a miner, and by reputation a con man, from Michigan by the name of Homer Pennock, brought a group of prospectors to the bay, organized as the Alaska Gold Mining Company. Homer Pennock settled on the broad sand beach and called his town site, not immodestly, Homer on the Spit. It was 1896, and the ramshackle community soon grew to over 200 miners and camp followers. Gold proved elusive, but Homer became a local supplier for the diggings at Sunrise and Hope and its neighboring town of Seldovia. When Homer and its docks were destroyed by fire in 1904, a new town sprang up on the shore overlooking the spit. Homesteads soon dotted the fertile tableland between the bluffs and the bay, and the mild climate and rich soil of the Kenai combined to make Homer a potentially bountiful agricultural community. In the early days, however, there were no roads except for the beach itself, and there was only infrequent communication with the outside world. Homer existed in peaceful semi-isolation, and its hardy residents subsisted on a basic diet of moose, potatoes, and fish during the moderate winter months. While mining provided a subsistence source of income, there was little incentive for residents to develop other resources. As one early settler recalled, at Homer, the easiest way to make a living was not by farming, but by trapping, mining, or fishing. Thus the early arrivals left the marvelously rich ground lie fallow, although they impressed visitors as being a people comfortably rural in attitude and outlook, who have preserved that friendliness and sense of cooperation that is rural America at its best. As more settlers arrived, the little community grew and physically expanded out beyond Beluga and Lampert Lakes and up the bluffs where Skyline Drive now winds its way. Agriculture, fox and mink fur farming, and fishing came to dominate the local economy, particularly during the years following government closure of the coal lands in Alaska. Old methods inevitably blended with the new, but Homer remained a tightly knit community which prided itself on self-help and hard labor. Early residents still look upon these times with fond memories, but recall that they paid their dues for what they built and endured both as individuals and as a community. Homer was never really a boomtown, but it survived out of stubbornness and love for a way of life which seemed clean and uncomplicated. Today, much of that same spirit is still visible in Homer, especially its rural character. Crops are harvested when families work together to produce much of what they need. A major shift in the economy occurred during the late 1920s and 1930s, when commercial fishing became Homer's mainstay. Not much gold was ever taken from the mines, but Ketchumet Bay and the Gulf of Alaska provided Homer with a bonanza from the sea. Fishing being easier and more profitable than farming, it dominated Homer's economy with a seasonal influx of fishermen and processors. Homer grew steadily but slowly with a brief surge during the peak years of the herring fishery until over-harvesting resulted in an economic downturn. Another resurgence occurred with development of the Tanner, King, and Dungeness crab, salmon and shrimp fisheries during the 1940s and 1950s. Slowly, quaint old Homer was transformed into an important regional commercial center. In 1938, the Homer Civic League was able to fund modern dock facilities. World War II brought military contracts and inflated spending, and the Homer Airfield was built in 1941. Population surged from 325 in 1940 to over 700 a decade later. Above all, however, Homer's future was dramatically changed with completion of a rough road connecting the lower Kenai Peninsula with Anchorage. This was the Sterling Highway, which, when paved in the 1960s, initiated a tremendous influx of tourists and would-be homesteaders, many of whom settled briefly, then left. "Too many people," one resident lamented, "come to our bit of paradise to live the good life, only to have their savings vanish. Finding it a losing struggle to acquire enough hard cash, they are forced to leave their shattered dreams scattered along our shore and hillsides." Today, however, Homer's new small boat harbor and impressive fish processing plants located in the Spitz industrial area suggest the health of the industry and the stability of the local economy. Little remains of the original Spit, which was all but destroyed by the 1964 earthquake. The once sparsely developed area was rebuilt and now is frequently jammed with campers and motorhomes, suggesting both the benefits and the drawbacks of ever-increasing numbers of tourists and Anchorage weekenders. Many residents decry what they see as the loss of Homer's old small-town character and feel that the pace and quality of change has gotten out of hand. Perhaps half of Homer, in the words of one resident, would have slammed the gate years ago. But many are now resigned to the inevitability of change and unfamiliar or even threatening economic and social values. Not long ago, a comprehensive development plan was put together by Homer residents, the city council, and an advisory planning commission in an effort to anticipate and direct these changes. The goal of the master plan was to provide for the planned and orderly growth within the city, to protect the city's beauty and resources while not denying its residents or outside landholders the reasonable use of their land, and to preserve a stable economic base for its citizens. But recently, and more often, the community finds itself deeply divided on how best to achieve these ideals while avoiding the pitfalls, how to balance social and physical environmental values against the need to maintain an expanding economy and to meet the demand for more services. Beyond the larger, sharply controversial issues such as impending outer continental shelf leasing, tourism, and the first real commitments to a bottom fishing industry, there are purely local problems of planning and zoning, the industrialization of the Spit, and the extension of city services to nearby Kachemak City. How will Homer meet the need for expanding services and higher city revenues and still maintain residential land values and aesthetic qualities distinctive of the Homer setting? How will Homer attract the needed state, federal, and private capital and corporate investment without inviting urban sprawl and the domination of local affairs by outside interests? And finally, how will Homer reconcile the human need for beauty and solitude with the community need of ultimately having to pay for them. In a northern setting where all too frequently individual human values and collective social priorities have become antagonists. Homer, like other small Alaskan communities, must come to terms with these conflicting needs while time permits participation in their resolution. Cordova is a picturesque community of 3,000, nestled on the southeast shore of Orca Inlet, near the eastern entrance to Prince William Sound. Cordova's setting is a rare blend of misty seascape, craggy coastal peaks, and massive glaciers. In a word, Cordova is breathtaking. Long before Captain James Cook sailed into Snug Corner Cove in 1778, Eyak and Tlingit Indians of the Copper River Delta camped, hunted, and fished in peaceful isolation where Cordova now stands. Although salmon canneries operated as early as 1899, it was not fish or game or scenic beauty which first drew whites to Orca Inlet. It was coal, oil, and copper, and the promise of fortunes to be made. Alaska's first oil well came in at Catala, just south of Cordova in 1902, and soon a boomtown mining black gold was attracting hundreds of roughnecks and drillers. In no time, coal miners began to produce high-grade fuel from the rich Bering River coal fields. On a tributary of the Chittenah River to the north, two prospectors discovered fabulously rich copper deposits in 1899. The East Coast Guggenheim faction gained control of the claims in 1905 and invested heavily in the region as the Alaska Syndicate. To get copper from the mines to Tidewater, however, they needed a railroad, so they simply built one. At first, Valdez was favored, and then Catala, described as a booming, brawling construction camp, seemed to have the edge in the deadly serious competition. But after a near hurricane destroyed Catala's facilities, a site on Orca Inlet was chosen by Irish engineer Michael J. Haney, builder of the famous White Pass and Yukon Railroad. With Haney's decision to build north from Orca Inlet, up the Copper River Valley to the mines, yet another booming construction town emerged almost overnight, this one beneath the slopes of Mount Eyak. Haney called the new town Cordova, and in 1906 he began laying a winding slash of steel rails across the mountains. Soon Cordova's docks were ablaze with activity as steamers offloaded tons of construction material, supplies, and workers. The Guggenheim crews built the railroad, and the railroad built Cordova. Work gangs cleared the right-of-way for what was to be known as the Copper River and Northwestern Railway, with Indian and white labor working together, enduring the demands of a ruthless construction schedule and the torturous routes through the Chugach Mountains. Within 5 years of beginning construction, trains were rolling on Michael Haney's railway, though he died before its completion. Surmounting the major hurdle of the Copper River crossing at mile 49, with construction of the million-dollar bridge, Haney's crews linked Cordova with the Kennecott Mines to complete what late Senator E.L. Bob Bartlett described as one of the greatest enterprises of Alaska's pioneer days. Novelist Rex Beach thought so too, as he penned his adventure yarn, The Iron Trail. In 1911, a copper spike was driven to secure the last rail in place and a place in history for the railroad in commemoration of the event. Cordova's future looked bright as the millions of dollars of 70% pure copper ore rolled to the sea, to eastern banks, and into the local economy. However, Cordova's promising future proved short-lived. Southeastern coal and timberlands became entangled in the government's new emphasis on conservation and environmental protection. Coal lands were withdrawn from entry, and over 4.5 million acres of forest was set aside as a Chugach National Forest. It was Alaska's first confrontation with national conservation movements. The conflict with development interests at Cordova resulted in one of the first acts of public protest in Alaska, when Cordovans dumped imported Canadian coal into Orca Inlet and their own version of the Boston Tea Party. Cries of lockup echoed throughout the territory, but to little avail. The hard truth was that Cordova fared as Kennecott fared, and in 1938, when the mines finally proved uneconomical to operate, Cordova's residents were faced with important decisions affecting their community's future. For Cordova, it was a time of change and often painful readjustment. Throughout the Kennecott-Guggenheim years, the town had prospered and grown. Cordova was a company town, but it was also a family town with schools, churches, recreation halls, hotels in a growing main street and business district. Even when half buried in snow, the city center had the look of a small but prosperous hillside community. For 20 years, accessible only by sea, by river, or by rough overland trails, Cordova entered the air age in 1933 with construction of its first airport. The absence of easy overland connections made Cordovans aware of their isolation from supply points and population centers, and many town boosters worked energetically for a road connection to Valdez and Chitna in the years following the end of World War II. Today, Cordova's main street bears little resemblance to its historic facade. Most of the town's history went up in smoke and flame as fires during the 1950s and 1960s tragically destroyed the old buildings of Main Street. The old railroad tracks were torn up during the 1940s for scrap and to make way for commercial expansion. It was a tragedy for some that a community so rich in history should retain so few reminders of its past, although others saw opportunity to build and modernize where before there had been only relics of another era. However, in many respects, Cordova's past is very much a part of its present and will certainly shape its future. To compensate for loss of its one major economic base, Cordova turned increasingly to commercial fishing, an industry which had always been of some local importance. The razor clam and salmon fisheries flourished. Cordova's packing plants and canneries became famous for their products: Channel Brand, Royal Red, Ocean Beauty, Hall's Offshore, and Conrad's Alaska Smoked, to name only a few. Today, fishing and fish processing are Cordova's main industries, a fact quickly confirmed by the town's crowded small boat harbor and processing complex. Each May, the boats put out to sea and return once a week to turn over their catch and re-outfit for the next run. Many boats are family operations, sons and daughters of fishermen keeping the family name in the business for years. This is Cordova's mainstay. Without the boats, the health of the fisheries, and the processing plants, Cordova's economic survival would be in jeopardy. Even so, in the best of circumstances, fishing is a seasonal and fragile way of life. Natural disaster, work stoppage, and fishermen's union or plant disputes can each cause severe hardship in a small community like Cordova. The vulnerability of essentially a one-economy town is also mirrored in local controversies at times overshadowed by statewide issues such as D2, antiquities withdrawals, Rare 2, bottom fishing, limited entry, oil development, heavy construction and industrial development, tourism, and native land management issues. If anything characterizes Cordova's future, it is a large question mark, with hard decisions facing the local business community, the fishermen's union, and the city government. There are real differences of opinion on what to do about the local economy, how or whether to diversify, the need for something more than seasonal employment, whether construction of the proposed Copper River Highway would ultimately enhance or destroy Cordova's serene small-town flavor, how to control rising costs of living reflected in skyrocketing utility costs, and how to prevent the outmigration of older families and sons and daughters who see no future here. Some memories of Cordova's past remain as images of an earlier time, not necessarily of better times, but of more secure times, before such things as native land claims and protective land withdrawals divided Cordovans into factions, each of which claims to have the town's future and best interests at heart. If we conserve, can we grow? If we protect, can we also exploit? Cordovans responded to such questions in a 1977 newspaper poll, itself a source of controversy. According to those who responded, economic activities and population growth were their number one concerns, followed by land use planning and the community environment. Cannery expansion and light manufacturing were favored as development options. Heavy manufacturing and outer continental shelf oil development, with Cordova as a staging area, were discouraged. A majority favored moderate growth and population increases, and most supported opening the Copper River Highway to supplement the ferry system. Significantly, there was an even split between concern for jobs and the community environment. And finally, Cordovans named local concerns rather than the larger issues of having greater impact on the community: cost of utilities, stray dogs, alcohol abuse, and property taxes, concerns which affect all people at the local level. Like all small towns, Cordova is somewhat at the mercy of outside interests, and many Cordovans are resigned to a degree of helplessness before big government. Others retain the spirit which caused coal to be dumped into the inlet in 1911. In the meantime, the fishing boats continue to go out with the tide over deep waters, framed against a clear sky. But there may be clouds on the horizon through which a difficult course will have to be charted before any clear solutions to these questions can be found. The small island community of Wrangell lies near the southern end of the Alaska Panhandle on Zamovia Strait, 85 air miles north of Ketchikan, 150 miles south of Juneau, and 750 miles north of Seattle. It is one of the oldest communities in Alaska. Russian fur traders first visited Wrangell's fog-bound shores in 1834, and they remained to exploit its coves and inlets. Alaska's second non-Aboriginal settlement emerged from the heavy rainforest as Red Out St. Denisius, but the island was known by several names depending on the occupants. To the British, it was Fort Stikeen. To the Americans, it was Wrangell, named for Baron Ferdinand von Wrangell, and subsequently Fort Wrangell, when Alaska became an American colony. The Russians found the island and mainland occupied by Stikeen River Tlingit Indians, who had evolved a fascinating totemic clan culture. However, ancient petroglyphs provided evidence of even earlier habitations. The Tlingits were more successful in resisting Russian domination than had been the Aleuts to the north. But eventually the arrival, first of the British Hudson's Bay men in the 1840s, and then American troops in 1867, resulted in accelerated cultural disruption and its attendant squalor, alcohol abuse, and material dependency. Because of Wrangell's strategic geographic proximity to British Canada, Americans built Fort Wrangell on the northwest tip of the island and maintained a lonely, isolated garrison there off and on for 40 years. Soon a small town sprang up, built from the rich abundance of local timber. Because of its location near the mouth of the Stikeen River, Wrangell became an important trading, transportation, and outfitting center for the rich Canadian northwest interior and southeast Alaska. By the 1880s, Wrangell had become the largest white settlement in Alaska, and the Cassiar gold strike turned the former Russian outpost into a raucous, hard-bit boomtown, the ships arriving from San Francisco and Victoria jammed with stampeders. Naturalist John Muir visited Wrangell in 1879 and described the town as the most inhospitable place at first sight I had ever seen. No mining hamlet in the placer gulches of California, nor any backwoods village I ever saw, approached it in picturesque devil-may-care abandon. Not content with this, Muir concluded by noting that Wrangell was a lawless draggle of wooden huts built in crooked lines, wrangling around the boggy shore of the island for a mile or so in the general form of a letter S, without the slightest subordination to the point of the compass or to building laws of any kind. During the 1890s, large numbers of Indians from surrounding villages settled near Wrangell seeking jobs, food, and hooch. Their plight helped convince the Presbyterian Church to open its first Alaska mission here under the direction of Reverends S. Hall Young and Dr. Sheldon Jackson, to educate and to cultivate souls for God. However, more worldly concerns characterized Wrangell's early development. To reap a harvest of another kind, the first salmon canneries were opened at Port Highfield on the northern tip of the island and elsewhere near the Stikeen Delta. Sawmill operations began with opening of the Wilson Sylvester Mill, predecessor of Alaska Lumber Products, to tap one of the richest timber areas of North America. With these two local industries, the foundations of Wrangell's economy were laid. The hysteria of the Klondike Rush in 1898 again briefly made Wrangell the center of frantic activity as the back door to the Yukon. One stampeder recalled that strange scenes of the old days were reenacted. The dance halls reopened, and Soapy Smith and his gang looked in and visited the saloons with their shell games and faro tables. The hurrying crowd camped on the old parade ground of the fort and turned the open places into a tent city. But once the flood of miners and opportunists washed over Wrangell, high times and easy money receded to leave only ruins and memories. However, the few hundred fishermen, lumberjacks, and their families, who found Wrangell's quiet isolation natural beauty and abundant resources attractive, remained to build, to settle, and to keep the little town alive. Ships would arrive each summer with imported Chinese labor to work the Glacier Packing Company canneries, and returned each fall with fish pack from the rich Annan Creek fishing grounds. Wrangell depended upon the coming and going of ships for most of what it was needed to keep the town going in the early days, and often 40 vessels dropped anchor each week in Wrangell's harbor. Today, lumber cargo vessels call at Wrangell as they have since the turn of the century, underscoring Wrangell's maritime setting and reforging its links with the past. The Alaska State Ferry System is the community's highway and provides the only access except by air and the only contact with the rest of the state and the outside world. If the early sailing ships brought gold seekers to Wrangell's shores, today the ferry system brings another kind of adventurer, the tourist, and his welcome dollars. As in other communities where tourism is becoming both big business and big headaches, Wrangell is divided over whether tourism should be expanded, and if it were, would the economic benefits outweigh social and environmental costs? Furthermore, the ferry system, which is at the nexus of the tourist industry in Southeast, is itself under a cloud of criticism for not being responsive to or meeting community needs. Timber, so important to Wrangell's past, holds the key to Wrangell's future. Alaska Lumber and Pulp operates two lumber mills, one in Wrangell and one on the Zamovia Highway near town. It and other operators harvest nearly 100 million board feet of Sitka spruce and hemlock annually. And although the mills are Japanese-owned, they are locally managed in an atmosphere of mutual benefit. The mill's payroll supports many families in the community, while thousands of tons of wood chips are shipped to Sitka for processing into pulp for Japan. It is little wonder that Wrangell is deeply concerned with the specter of D2 and wilderness classifications for the Tongass National Forest and proposed U.S. Forest Service Rare 2 guidelines. Many of Wrangell's community and business leaders are active in statewide anti-conservation organizations seeking more balanced use of the Tongass resources in an effort to prevent what most Wrangell residents see as impending economic disaster and the end of a way of life. Wrangell is still nearly 20% Indian, and the Stikine Native organization continues to exert local economic and social influences in the community, which will probably have even greater impact as land entitlements are finalized, easements determined, and Native investment committed. Unmistakably, there are strong Native white feelings in Wrangell, as elsewhere in the state, and such feelings surface as the most evident cost of continuing cultural adjustment and changing realities. Like Homer and Cordova, Wrangell has a strong fishing tradition. Its two small boat harbors, coal storage facilities, and canneries represent an important secondary industry. Harbor Seafoods Company and Reliant Shrimp Company provide seasonal employment for plant workers and fishermen who carry on family and community traditions. The sea and those who exploit her riches and weather her moods give Wrangell a special character of its own. It is above all this special character which Wrangell's residents feel must be preserved against the serious challenges it currently faces. Wrangell shares many of the common fears and dilemmas faced by other small Alaskan communities, such as Nenana, Homer, and Cordova. How to preserve the best of its unique community, family, and individual qualities, its small-town, independent character. How to effectively confront fast-moving events and to arrive at objective, rationally-based decisions on issues which are subject to everything from high emotionalism to indifference to self-interest to sensitivity. How to achieve a balance between the imperative to provide for the community's needs and to build a future for growing families in a changing world, and the human necessity to retain a sense of continuity with the past in order to guide decisions with the benefit of established and shared values. While these communities anticipate the changes and uncertainties of the future, they seek perception and the insight to meet these challenges by reassessing where they are in terms of where they have been. For the present, there remains this contrast and this possibility that the changes which have overtaken, and many would say have overwhelmed, Alaska's two largest communities are, for Nenana, Homer, Cordova, and Wrangell, still within their power to shape and to direct towards that blending of values and trade-offs which they must take responsibility for, and with which their children ultimately must live.